Hey everybody, welcome to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I will be your host for the next hour. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much for choosing to spend some time with me. And I've got a great show this evening. We're going to be talking about AI. That's right, artificial intelligence. And specifically, we're going to be talking about a book called AI Snake Oil, which was co-written by Arvind Narayanan and Sayesh Kapoor. Professor Narayanan teaches computer science at Princeton University, and Sayesh Kapoor is a PhD student there. And the book is also published at Princeton by Princeton University Press. I really liked this book. You're going to hear in the interview, it goes over quite a bit of material, and I try to cover a lot of the high points in this interview. But true to the title, AI Snake Oil, I was interested to dive into this book because it just doesn't seem like a lot of the promise and hype that we hear about AI day-to-day is just overblown. And even when you get predictions from some of these tech leaders, oh, we're going to have artificial general intelligence, maybe even sentience within 2 years. And then 2 years go by. Oh, well, maybe 5 years. And then 5 years go by. And then, well, maybe later. We see these promises that are just overstated again and again. And so it was refreshing to read a book written by two people who really know this area. They're from inside the tech industry, at least the academic side, and they're writing with deep knowledge of the subject and saying a lot of this, not all, a lot of this is snake oil. And of course, AI means a lot of different things to different people, and so I feel like AI is an umbrella marketing term. So the first thing we have to do is understand when we say AI and when some of those tech bros say AI, what is it exactly that they're talking about? Because as the authors point out, there are examples of AI that we have been using successfully for years and we're all kind of used to. They give examples like speech recognition and spam filters and even spell check. Do you spell check when you're writing a document or an email or something? That uses a kind of AI. And there's this old phrase that once people get used to it, it's no longer considered AI. But really, if you look under the hood, the technology that's underneath those features like spell check and even autocomplete and autopilot in planes, it's actually AI just as much as any of the AI that's being overblown is. So I found this book and this discussion helpful to distinguish between where the AI actually is helpful and legitimate and versus where it's not. And so the full title of the book is AI Snake Oil: What Artificial Intelligence Can Do, What It Can't, and How to Tell the Difference. I want to go ahead and play this interview for you, and we can dive more into those topics. We are going to hear from Professor Arvind Narayanan from Princeton, co-author of the book AI Snake Oil, here on Tectonic. Arvind Narayanan, welcome to Tectonic.
Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. I really enjoyed your new book, AI Snake Oil, which you co-wrote with Sayesh Kapoor. This is a welcome dose of reality in a hype-filled area, clearly distinguishing between, as the subtitle says, what artificial intelligence can do and what it can't. I'd like to start by talking about predictive AI, which is the kind of AI that automates decision-making based on some calculated prediction of the future. For example, you write that, quote, when you show up at a hospital, an algorithm could determine if you need to be admitted overnight or released the same day. It's not just hospitals. You mention job applications, criminal justice, welfare, education, finance, all areas where you say, quote, predictive AI has largely flown under the radar as subjects don't even know they're being automatically evaluated. Okay, so for people who don't understand the spread of this technology, how do you introduce them to predictive AI?
Sure, yeah. So that's one of the key points behind the book. AI is an umbrella term. It means many different things. We usually think of consumer-facing AI, which tends to be generative AI, things like ChatGPT, image generators, and so forth. That's an area where there has been rapid technological progress. But on the other hand, something that's been happening for much longer, perhaps a couple of decades, is predictive AI. This is not consumer technology. It's making decisions about us instead of being something that we use. It's used by companies and governments. And so when you apply for a job, for instance, it's very common these days for there to be some sort of AI involved, perhaps in many steps of the process, but very commonly for screening resumes, for instance. And going beyond this, in fact, the reason I started thinking about this topic was 5 years ago, I started seeing these products where these AI vendors were going to HR departments and saying, look, you're getting hundreds, maybe 1,000 applications for each open position. You can't possibly manually go through all of it. So use our AI, and it's going to do a video interview with the candidate. And the candidate is not even talking about their job qualifications or whatever, but just about their hobbies and that sort of thing. And the AI is going to use their body language and facial expressions to figure out their personality and their suitability for the job. I was like, what? You know, and this is happening on a massive scale, right? Tens of millions of Americans have been asked to do this kind of AI video assessment, and there is no evidence that it works. And as a computer scientist, I can tell you there is no known way by which it could work. And so that's an example of predictive AI. So I usually like to start with an example that seems to clearly make no sense and yet is very widely deployed. We're not saying all predictive AI is problematic or doesn't work, but a lot of it is.
You mentioned that you're a computer science. I think we should probably establish you're a professor of computer science at Princeton.
That's right. That's right. I'm a professor of computer science at Princeton, and my co-author, Sayash Kapoor, is a computer scientist. He's getting his PhD, and he's had engineering roles in the industry working on developing and deploying AI technologies. So we come into this with a lot of both theoretical and practical knowledge.
Which is why it's extra refreshing to see people with this knowledge of the technology and the industry coming out and saying, hey, a lot of this is snake oil, and here's what's good about it, but here are a lot of the harms. One of the risks you write about is something you call over-automation, in which decisions are made automatically, affecting people's lives without, in a lot of cases, giving those people any recourse if there's a mistake made. You cite examples of state agencies wrongly fining citizens and then, when challenged, saying, well, someone is supposed to be monitoring what the AI is doing. But then it turns out that humans weren't actually in the loop, because when the AI spit out the answer, no one questioned it because that was the answer from the technology. How widespread are these problems from over-automation?
I would say very widespread. The fundamental issue is that when you're a public sector agency or a company that needs to make decisions about people and you're moving to an automated process, the big part of the motivation for automated decision-making, whether in the public sector or private sector, is cost saving. Right? You want to minimize the number of people who are involved in manually making those decisions. And I get that. Of course, it makes sense to look for efficiencies. But that does mean that there is a perpetual tension between the whole reason you're putting this automated system into place and protecting the rights of people about whom you're making decisions. And I think it's exacerbated because a lot of these AI vendors, it's broader than an AI problem, by the way. A lot of these software vendors for making these automated decisions will advertise these as enabling efficiency, enabling cost cutting, but then they will have fine print saying you're supposed to have a human in the loop monitoring every single decision. And so there's kind of a diffusion of responsibility. Is it the AI vendor's fault or is it the person deploying it? And so that's where things get murky and the opportunity to appeal or contest decisions kind of goes away. Even if it exists in theory, it might not really be available in practice.
And what are people supposed to do if they're harmed by one of these predictive AIs? I mean, first, I guess the question would be, how would people know if they were fined unfairly or if they didn't get the job? And then second, if they somehow do get that awareness, what's the 1-800 number they're supposed to call?
Yeah, that's the problem. It doesn't exist. And I don't know that this can be handled at the level of individuals trying to advocate for themselves. I think that needs to happen as well, but it's a broader structural problem. I think the more effective solutions involve regulation, involve ways in which journalists, for instance, can hold companies accountable for having these systems that make decisions that keep going wrong. So we have seen a lot of those efforts. Those have been somewhat effective. I think whistleblowers inside companies are really important, right? When you're working for a company that asks you to deploy an algorithm that you have qualms about, I think it's important to protect the rights of those folks to speak up. Those are some of the most important ways in which the rest of us can get a better understanding of what's going on.
I appreciated that in this book, you're not just talking about policy problems and recommendations like we're doing now. You're also going into the technology itself, and you explain how the technology works and why there are some problems that are inherent to the, in some cases, the design of the technology. Here's one example I really liked. This was an example from a hospital setting. Using AI, researchers at this hospital found that among patients with pneumonia, the patients who also had asthma seemed to recover faster or have fewer complications based on the data. What was wrong with the AI-based analysis in that case?
This was a true pattern in the data. So in some sense, nothing went wrong, which leads to a mystery. How could it be that having asthma lowers your complications? So it turns out that's because in the hospital's existing system, the clinicians would diagnose what was going on with the patient. And if they were asthmatic, they would know that there was a higher chance of complications and they would be more likely to get sent to the ICU where they would have a lot of care that would minimize the likelihood of those complications. So from that perspective, you know, if what we were hoping to answer is the system working, right? Are we doing the right thing by these asthma patients? And the answer is yes. We found that pattern in the data. But the problem was the intention was for this AI system to replace the existing triage method in the hospital. And that would have been catastrophic because turning an observation into a decision-making system, which is kind of the logic behind a lot of these AI-based automated decision-making systems, right? So to learn from the past and to do that in the future, that can easily go wrong unless you have a real understanding of the nuances of the data you're looking at. So fortunately, in this case, the researchers noticed what was going on. The system was never put into practice, but there have been others like it that have been used in, you know, life and death medical settings, unfortunately.
You write that, quote, AI can make good predictions if nothing else changes. Can you explain that? I feel like there's a lot packed into that sentence that explains why predictive AI so often is instrumented into making poor decisions.
Right. It follows from what we've just been talking about, that the core logic here is to learn patterns from the past and to sort of enact those patterns, right? And to reify, to solidify those patterns in future decision making. So two things can go wrong here. One is just from a practical perspective, you're making decisions about people, you know, potentially adverse decisions, and they might not like those decisions. And so, you know, as smart as we think these AI systems might be, they're ultimately at least these predictive AI systems, they're just pattern matchers. They don't have common sense. So people can easily find ways around this system. So some of the hiring AI tools, for instance, ask people questions like, is your room usually neat or tidy? And, you know, somehow see how that correlates that with past performers at the company. I mean, you know, all it takes is to just kind of reverse engineer which of these answers is more likely to lead to a favorable response. And then that knowledge can be spread among the community of people who are being subject to these decisions. In fact, people have been, job seekers have been using AI to improve their chances in various ways. One simple one is just using these AI tools to apply to lots of different open positions, but also to tailor the language in your cover letter to match what the position seems to be looking for, to more subtle ones, to putting some skills that you don't necessarily have in white font on the page so that the AI system will read it, but it won't be apparent to a human recruiter, right? So those are all many ways in which systems can be gamed. So that's one thing that we mean by it can work well if nothing changes about the people or the scenario in which it's deployed.
Basically, if someone doesn't game the system, you're saying, then it would work fine.
Right. But gaming is not the only thing. There are things that can go wrong in even more benign ways. So you might train a medical system on one hospital, but then when you're deploying it to another hospital, which is like the whole point of these things, right? You build the automation once and you deploy it everywhere. But then the characteristics of one patient population might differ from another, so it might actually make much poorer predictions for them than you originally thought it did. And we've seen this kind of failure over and over again.
In this book, you don't just talk about predictive AI. You also talk about generative AI and the use of AI for social media moderation, which we'll get beyond predictive AI in a second. But predictive AI in particular of those three buckets, you have a rather negative view of, I guess I could put it that way. You have a conclusion that, as you put it, predictive AI not only does not work today, but will likely never work. Is it those two flaws that we just talked about that are making predictive AI inherently unworkable?
So we are inherently suspicious of predictive AI, but not necessarily every application of predictive AI. We do think we should start from a position of skepticism, but then in some cases, I think its use can be justified. So as a simple example, I mean, there's a lot of complexity, but to make it a little simpler, banks have to make predictions of the riskiness of borrowers, because otherwise they'll go out of business. Yes, there are things we need to consider. Are those predictions, you know, discriminatory in various ways? Is the data used for making those decisions accurate? But fundamentally, you have to have some sort of prediction in that scenario. But in a lot of other cases, I think these predictions are being made in situations where, first of all, the future is not that predictable. The reason it doesn't work that well in hiring is, yeah, you can check for basic qualifications, you know, which anyone can do. You don't really need AI for that. But the things that AI is being used for, to try to somehow get to a prediction of the fit between this particular job candidate and their set of skills and the needs of this position, that's, in my view, based on some research that I've seen, but just based on personal experience as well, fundamentally unpredictable. A lot of that comes down to information that's simply not even available at the time of making the decision, like how well someone's going to gel with their coworkers. Right? What might go wrong in their personal life that might prevent them from performing well in the workplace? So those are the reasons why this kind of prediction is hard. It's not because we don't have sufficiently clever algorithms. So all of this work that's going into getting more and more data, surveilling people, putting all these algorithms into place, it hasn't really led to much improvement in most of these domains. So in criminal justice, for instance, there is a lot of data when these algorithms are trying to predict who is going to commit a crime. They work slightly better than random, right? And yeah, I mean, one kind of purely utilitarian way to look at it is anything better than random is good. But another way to look at it is, how is it morally justified to jail someone, you know, until their trial, which might be months or years away, based on a prediction that they will commit crime in the future, as opposed to a determination of guilt? Have we so easily accepted pre-crime? So that's kind of what we mean when we're skeptical about predictive AI. So it's a couple of different things. One, it doesn't work well because you can't really predict the future. And the second is, especially considering how poorly it works, is it even morally justified to be making these predictions at all?
You mentioned surveillance just then. And of course, training these AI models requires huge amounts of data. And so there's an obvious incentive for companies and state actors to gather as much data from citizens or users as they can. And you write about AI and surveillance. In one section, you paint a rather dystopian picture of what could happen if this really scales up, the surveillance. You write, quote, "A dystopian possibility is to collect extensive information on each person everywhere. Everyone would be under constant surveillance. The systems would be tracking every spoken word, every movement, every action, and perhaps every electrical signal in their brain." And to me, that sounds like a terrible science fiction plot. But then a couple of weeks ago, I came across this quote from Oracle founder Larry Ellison speaking publicly and saying that he thought an ideal society would be one in which citizens were tracked and monitored every word, every movement, everything that you just said. How likely is it that we're going to see AI deployed for, I mean, it already is deployed for surveillance, but I guess how much more of this are we going to see?
Right. There's a technical dimension of this and a moral dimension of this. From a technical perspective, yeah, I mean, it might seem like sci-fi, at least at first. But if you were to go back, you know, 20, 30 years and tell people that all of our online clicks and searches are going to be monitored for advertising, right? So that would have seemed exceedingly implausible and dystopian. And yet that is exactly what has been happening for more than a decade. And a lot of my past research on privacy and surveillance was about exposing the amount of online tracking that's constantly happening on websites and apps and our devices in general. So that's one thing. Technically speaking, yeah, it's quite possible. I mean, I think at some point, brain-computer interfaces are likely to become pretty widely used. And
I'm just shaking my head.
Yeah, I can see that. If they are going to be used, the way they're going to work is for a lot of our electrical signal data to then be stored on our devices, hopefully on our devices and not the cloud somewhere that we don't have control over. And from there, it's just one step to using that for surveillance, right? So yeah, technically speaking, it's quite possible the preconditions for this will be created. But like morally and politically, is this likely to happen? I think 10 years ago, I would have said yes, but now I'm a little more optimistic. I think when we look at the arc of privacy after Snowden, after the Cambridge Analytica revelations, there's a lot that has changed, both in terms of laws. In the EU, you have the General Data Protection Regulation, which also has impacts outside the EU. And in the US, we don't have comprehensive federal privacy legislation, but a lot of states have taken up this particular area. And beyond that, you also see companies, for instance, device makers and browser makers having various measures to control tracking, and that has been a very positive development as well. So I think if there is awareness among the public and if the political will is there, you can bend the arc of history in ways that are more rights respecting. I'm not a technological determinist. I don't think technology itself and its technical properties determine the way in which it will impact society. I do think we have agency, and that's really part of the reason that we wrote this book.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. And we are about halfway through my interview with Arvind Narayanan, co-author of the new book, AI Snake Oil: What Artificial Intelligence Can Do, What It Can't, and How to Tell the Difference. I hope you are enjoying the interview so far. We're going to get into some other areas of AI beyond predictive AI in the second half of the interview. Let's go ahead and listen to that now, here on Tectonic. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about generative AI. As I said earlier, you write about predictive AI and generative AI and moderation using AI and social media. Generative AI, I think most listeners are familiar with in one form or another, tools like ChatGPT and DALL-E, whether generating text or images, are pretty popular these days. There's definitely some uses for these tools, but I was happy that you called out some of the risks in generative AI tools. You write about misinformation and deepfakes and centralization of power within the companies that make these tools. But then you write something I found very interesting. You said, quote, "The most serious harm from generative AI, in our view, is the labor exploitation that is at the core of the way it is built and deployed today." Okay, listeners may not understand this. They might think, hey, I thought the chatbot was all automated. Can you explain the problems associated with labor exploitation in generative AI?
When a company is building a chatbot or an image generator or any other kind of generative AI, a lot of that data comes from data collected from the web. In fact, most of that data. However, there is so much, you know, garbage on the web, for lack of a better word, and companies have to filter this before it goes into the training data of the AI system. And that's where human labor comes in. This is usually outsourced to people in developing countries. We don't even have an order of magnitude estimate of the number of people who are involved in this, but we can confidently say that the number of workers is in the millions. So it's a lot of jobs. It's not steady employment. It's, you know, you wake up one day and you don't know if you have a new gig coming your way or not, because the company might say, oh, we've finished training this model, we're done, pack up and leave, et cetera. So the working conditions are not great. It's often trauma-inducing work, because the work, by definition, is filtering out the worst of the internet from the training data of these models, right? All that gore and violence and various other stuff, who knows what not, toxic diatribes that are online. So yeah, it's problematic labor in a lot of ways. I think the wages are in line with the prevailing wages in those countries. However, the quality of the job is much poorer. But also, I think this is not something we should simply leave to the market. Whenever we bring this up, this is always the response from the defenders of AI. It's like, oh, you know, it's a better option for them than whatever else they can do in their economies. Well, from a very narrow perspective, that's true. But it just lacks any kind of imagination of how things could be better. And the best way to illustrate that is through the historical analogy of the Industrial Revolution, which has a lot of similarities with AI. I mean, I don't know if AI is going to be as impactful as the Industrial Revolution, but let's assume it's going to be, right? Even in that case, I claim there is a lot we need to worry about and fix, because for the Industrial Revolution's benefits to be felt, especially broadly felt, it took several decades. But those intervening decades were a terrible time for workers. It led to mass migration from rural areas to the cities, where people lived in crowded tenements. There were no worker safety regulations. The hours were terrible, you know, 14 hours a day of backbreaking labor, just horrible in every way, right? That was the origin of the modern labor movement. Right. So imagine someone back then saying, oh, you know, they're still making more money than they would have on the farm. How unsatisfying that answer would be to our modern ears if they had no bargaining power. Right. So collective bargaining is one thing that breaks down. And that's why that market doesn't even function. So it's not just that you're leaving it to the market, you're leaving it to a dysfunctional market. So I think that's where we are with the kind of labor that goes into AI. And that's why I think it really requires intervention.
Yeah, you mentioned regulation. Actually, throughout the book, you're mentioning regulation as a possible fix, because the self-regulation of the tech industry hasn't worked and it is not going to work, obviously. In terms of generative AI, you mentioned that one possible reaction for an individual out there, a user, might be not to use generative AI at all, or to try to avoid the tools because they feel they're morally reprehensible in that way. But you do suggest that collective action and perhaps a new labor movement is a better way forward. And I agree with you. And I have the same reaction that I have with a lot of other guests when we get to the solutions, which is, what are the chances that we're going to win on this? You know, some people opting out individually and other people going to union meetings. Do you feel hopeful that we're going to see some resolution as we did in the Industrial Revolution with better regulations? Because it seems like these companies are just so powerful and resistant to regulation right now.
I think it's really about the time horizon, and in the next, let's say, 2 years. Am I optimistic? I'm not. But some might say that that's horrible. These harms are happening right now. I mean, I agree. But I think we have to take what we can get. I think it takes some time to build awareness and power. So if we look at another kind of algorithmic harm, which is these machine learning models picking up the stereotypes, historical prejudices that are in the data, and then reproducing them when they make decisions about new people. Over a 10-year period, there has been a great deal of recognition of that. There has been regulation. There has been a change of practices. So, you know, I do think change is possible. And privacy, again, we've seen change. It does take at least a decade or more. And the specific kind of solution might be different in every case, right? So with this kind of global labor exploitation thing, it might be some version of the fair trade movement, for instance, but just backed with more actual regulatory muscle. So I think we have to be innovative on exactly what form it's going to take. But in a long-term perspective, yes, I would call myself optimistic. Maybe that's naive, but we'll see.
Now, you mentioned in your discussions of generative AI something I found very interesting, which is that you are excited about the use of generative AI in the classroom. As we said before, you're a professor of computer science at Princeton. I was very curious to ask you, what have you used generative AI for with the students? Because I've heard from other educators who say, no, I try to keep Gen AI out of the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, I respect the other perspective, but I have certainly embraced it. So first of all, let me talk about my own use of generative AI for learning. When these models first started getting capable enough that it became even conceivable to use it to learn new topics, at first, I thought that's a terrible thing to do because they tend to, quote unquote, hallucinate, which is generate wrong responses because they're just statistical, word remixers, basically. But once I tried using it for that purpose, I realized there were a lot of advantages. I haven't stopped using books for learning, but I can't ask a book a question, and I can't summarize my knowledge of a question to a book and ask it if I've made any mistakes. Those are things I can do with ChatGPT and other tools like that. And, you can use them in a way that you ask them to produce citations and then you go check things yourself. So you can work your way around the inevitable mistakes that they're going to make. And I also found that knowing that anything it says could be incorrect forced me to be in a perpetually critical frame of mind, which is perfect for learning, which is what you want anyway, right? So I found that there are a lot of advantages, and specifically in computer science for things like programming, there are fun and interesting and deep and important parts. And then there's the drudgery. So much of programming is drudgery, right? I mean, I'm sure you know this with your programming background. And so if you can automate the drudgery, it frees up more time and more of your attention to focus on the more important parts, and also makes things more fun. So when it comes to my students, I encourage them to use it however they see fit. And I design my homeworks such that even if they are using AI, it's not going to be trivial to get an A. In fact, typically, if they just paste everything into AI, they're probably going to get a B range grade. And look, if that's what they want to do, I can't stop them. And even if it weren't for AI, there are other ways for them to do that, coast through the class. I'm not going to be able to stop them. I don't worry too much about that. Most students don't want that. That's the good news. And so I think, I trust my students to find ways to use AI productively instead of for cheating. I do require them to disclose all the ways in which they've used AI in their homework. And I trust those responses. So my assessment is that there are healthy ways to use AI for learning, and it does require some amount of trust in the students.
Let's talk a little bit about the third type of AI or I guess the third use of AI that you cover in the book, which is the use of AI for moderation in social media. You have a chapter called Why AI Can't Fix Social Media. And you write, quote, "The problems with social media are inherent in their design and cannot be fixed by the whack-a-mole approach of content moderation." Okay, so if I understand right, what we have here is social media feeds that are full of, as you say, garbage in a lot of cases, and humans and AI often work together. Sometimes it's the exploited laborer looking at some of these problematic posts. And companies like Facebook have said, we're doing better. You know, we're catching more and more of this garbage. And look at this new AI that we're investing in. You're saying that this is not the long-term solution that the companies claim it is. Why is that?
Right. So AI is useful here in looking at posts on social media and figuring out which ones violate the company's policies and taking them down or taking some other action on that post. And AI has long been used for that since the beginnings of social media content moderation, going back more than a decade. And it's improving. So in some sense, companies are doing better. But the reason it's not a full solution is when we look at what is causing the problems in the first place. What is leading to an amplification of a lot of the problematic content on social media is the design of these platforms that rewards the kind of more extreme kind of speech to, you know, to go more viral. And that's kind of inherent in the design of any social media platform, but especially when you have algorithmic recommendation systems that optimize for engagement, that optimize for keeping people hooked on the apps for longer, that problem becomes even worse. So it's like, you know, one side of the house is creating the problems that the other side is trying to put out. So that's the dynamic that you've got going on inside social media companies. And in fact, a lot of these teams internally are at loggerheads with each other because they're fully aware that this is what is going on. So that's the first problem. And the second problem is that the challenge of cleaning up social media is not just a matter of, quote unquote, taking out the trash, right? I mean, that's a simplistic way to look at it. But one person's trash is another person's free expression. And that's really why social media platforms have come under fire. And I do think the free expression aspect of it is really, really important. And if they don't pay attention to that, these platforms are not going to have legitimacy. That's one area where they've said, oh, you know, yeah, we understand that you don't trust us because they're unelected arbiters of the public square to draw the line between how much to protect free expression and how much to cut down on harassment. But we're going to leave it to this objective and neutral data-driven technology. And we think that's not going to work because the platforms don't have legitimacy. And they're bringing in a tool that also doesn't have legitimacy to make these decisions that are fundamentally about our values and how do you balance, you know, the needs of different stakeholders. And there is no objective right solution to it. And if you try to do that, you're just going to have both sides upset at you instead of just one.
Yeah, I like how you describe those two problems. It sounds like it's the problem of false positives and false negatives. One of them is someone says, this is garbage and should not be in my feed, and it is. Another person says, my legitimate post should be in their feed, but it's not.
Right.
Another section of the book I liked a lot was when you discussed the problem of AI hype. That is, all of the overbaked claims we've heard for years about AI is going to change the world and AI can do these things. And what's just around the corner is this huge leap in the competency of AI. And you detail the various incentives of the actors who are promoting this hype, the companies, the investors, and the journalists. And I guess a fourth category would be public figures. There's this one particularly egregious quote that you include from AI pioneer Jeffrey Hinton. He said in 2016, quote, "People should stop training radiologists now. It's just completely obvious that within 5 years, deep learning is going to do better than radiologists." And then you follow that with a comment that I found very dry and to the point. You write, "In 2022, there was a worldwide shortage of radiologists. AI has not even come close to replacing radiologists." So Arvind, why are AI leaders and companies and journalists and so on, why are these actors so persistent in spreading hype like this? It sounds like it would be a bad long-term strategy to say these things and then a few years later to be proven wrong.
I mean, Jeff Hinton, you know, truly believes what he claimed, and now he has just slightly modified his claims. I forget the details, but it's maybe that he just got the timing wrong, or it's not radiologists, or it's someone else now. That's part of the problem, right? A lot of the people putting out this hype, you know, unlike the snake oil salesman of the 19th century, really believe this stuff. And there's a big selection effect. So a lot of the reason that students go into computer science and AI is because they think that it can really, you know, really change the world and usher in a post-human age or whatever some of those more sci-fi visions are. And they really want to believe that they're a part of that, you know, whether for good or when they're warning about the risks of building this technology. So that's one issue. The second issue is, it's really unfortunate that we give so much deference to the predictions of AI pioneers who are very good at one thing, right? Building algorithms and coming up with technical solutions for improving how AI works, but often are really bad, you know, worse than the average person at understanding the societal implications of technologies. A lot of the AI researchers who are making these predictions about job displacement don't have even the most basic understanding of the job functions of the people that they're talking about. To them, everything is this kind of prediction problem or classification problem or a computational problem, which can, you know, potentially be automated for AI, but they miss that that's only one of the 20 things that this expert does, and it's all about integrating that particular task with all of the other things that happen in the process of doing radiology, right? I mean, first of all, there's interventional radiology and there's diagnostic radiology. So all of this talk only applies to diagnostic radiologists. And I'm not even sure if the people making these claims are aware of that distinction, right? Like the number one most basic thing that you could potentially know about the profession of radiology. So yeah, so you know they don't know much about the occupations that they're critiquing. They don't know much about how society typically tends to respond to technology, all the headwinds that are built into the rapid adoption of technology, the reasons that it doesn't happen so rapidly as you might think, the reason why adoption of technology sometimes lags decades behind the development of that technology. They don't understand how regulation works. They have too cynical a view of government. So I think all of this together results in just a very particular style of thinking that just, first of all, assumes everyone else is an idiot. And when they look at all these people who don't believe these claims about the technology proclamations that AI researchers are making, they assume that it's a combination of unawareness, but also feeling threatened by this technology and not wanting to accept that it's here and it's going to change all our lives. And so it, you know, leads them further down the spiral of thinking that everybody else is stupid and they alone are out there speaking the truth about what is going to happen to our world. It's a pretty depressing place.
So they don't understand the occupations that they're making predictions about. They don't understand how technology actually affects society. They don't understand how regulation works. But other than that, Arvind, oh, brother.
And we were talking about journalists, and journalists have their own incentives, right? And so there, I think the main problem is just the financial crunch that so many newsrooms are under. And so there is such a pressure to just take what a company is claiming and then, you know, put in a quote from some independent expert who might not be so independent and then hit publish, right? So I think that's the reason a lot of the media hype comes about.
Totally. And so it's perverse because they're reporting on AI because of the squeeze in their business model, which in part came from those same companies that made the AI.
Exactly.
And similarly, you write about a lot of the academic research around AI is also quietly funded by those same companies. And so there's an incentive to come back with results that boost the technology.
That's right. And there's so much overhyped academic research, yeah, which in turn contributes to all of this. And so what it means is that a lot of the time, even when you try to go to an independent expert who might assess what is going on, they have their own incentives to be hyping things up. This is one way in which computer science is different from many other disciplines. So in medicine, for instance, there is a clear understanding in the profession that pharma has its own incentives to exaggerate the efficacy of drugs or to minimize the harms of certain things. And so there's a little bit of a separation of church and state. So medical doctors and academic MDs are very careful about potential conflicts of interest, and they see their mission as being a little bit different from what the goals of the pharma companies are. Computer science is not a discipline that is set up like that, for good or bad. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing or that it's even practical to have this kind of strict separation, but it does mean that we don't have any kind of corpus of independent technical experts whose incentives are completely distinct from those of the tech industry.
We're running out of time, but I did have one question along these lines I wanted to ask you. Speaking of the computer scientists who are entering industry coming out of places like Princeton, what, if anything, are you talking to your students about to get them thinking about these ethical and moral issues before they enter this somewhat depressing tech ecosystem?
The good news is that they're all thinking about them. I mean, when they're at a university, you know, they haven't really yet entered this bubble. And so they are aware of all of the things that are going wrong in the tech industry, and they really want to learn how to do better. And a lot of engineers, even after they go into the tech industry, they are sometimes quietly, sometimes loudly doing the right thing. But they're in an environment where, first of all, intellectually, epistemically, there's this bubble, right, with people's beliefs, people who are in Silicon Valley, their beliefs diverging from, you know, common sense or evidence-informed views that one might have if one weren't in that bubble. And the commercial pressures are very, very serious. So I think both of those are issues. So I don't think we're going wrong in the training of these students before they enter the industry. It's what happens after, and that's really the issue.
I want to finish the interview with a quote you wrote somewhere near the end of the book, which I thought was a great summation of the entire book. After these chapters about the risks and opportunities of different kinds of AI, you write this, quote, "We don't need to predict the future to decide what the best next steps are today." I thought that was so well said, that we have a good moral sense today for what we should do to regulate, reorganize, educate, and provide a better foundation for this technology actually to do good in society. And we don't need an AI to predict the future in order to get us there. And this book is a great resource for anyone who wants to build that foundation for themselves. It's called AI Snake Oil: What Artificial Intelligence Can Do, What It Can't, and How to Tell the Difference, written by my guest today, Arvind Narayanan, and your co-author, Sayesh Kapoor. Arvind, thanks so much for being on Tectonic today.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a really fun conversation.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the remaining several minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Arvind Narayanan, co-author of the new book, AI Snake Oil: What Artificial Intelligence Can Do, What It Can't, and How to Tell the Difference. It's published by Princeton University Press and co-authored by Sayesh Kapoor. Really appreciated Arvind's time in speaking with me. And as you heard, we covered a lot of ground, covering predictive AI and generative AI and the use of AI in moderation of social media, the three main buckets of the book. And I would really recommend this book. If you just want an overview of where AI is right now, and I think this book is going to have some good shelf life as well. If you don't get to it right away, I think it's still going to be, this is one of those books that is foundational and is going to still be helping people understand this technology of, as the subtitle says, what it can and can't do, in a couple of years still. So thanks to Arvind for that. I have put some links to the book and some related, pieces
on the playlist. You can get to the playlist if you go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and find the show that features Arvind Narayanan and AI Snake Oil. There's a link to the book. And by the way, on my playlist, I always link to the book where there is an author via bookshop.org. I never use your well-known monopolist bookstore. Please don't buy books from the monopoly unless there is absolutely no other option. But yeah, there's a link to bookshop.org that places the order through independent books bookstores. They have a newsletter, an email newsletter at aisnakeoil.com, and a couple other links. In the couple of minutes I have left, I wanted to go over a real-world example that was in the news. Oh, this is a while ago now, but there was an echo last week. This was, let me tell you what I'm talking about. This is a story about predictive AI and how it went wrong and allegedly harmed a lot of people. This is a story from Ars Technica. This is from November 16, 2023. Okay, so a little while ago. But it's about an AI algorithm that was employed by United Health. And of course, when I say United Health, many or most listeners are going to think about the shooting that that recently occurred in Midtown Manhattan. The CEO of United Health was gunned down. And of course, we don't know for sure the shooter's motives, but there has been a lot of comment online and in major media talking about the widespread anger at companies like United Health among American citizens for the repeated denials of care or denials of claims. And again, this is a story from November 2023. The headline is United Health uses AI model with 90% error rate to deny care, lawsuit alleges. And I should note that those last two words, this is all alleged by a lawsuit that was reported in this Ars Technica story. And the story talks about how United Health used, I don't know if they still use this algorithm, but at the time they used an algorithm that internally to United Health was called NH Predict. The letters NH and then the word predict. And the idea of NH Predict, as the name suggests, was about using AI to predict future outcomes. In other words, exactly what Arvind Narayanan is warning against for all the reasons that we went over in the interview. And yet this AI was employed to predict future outcomes. For example, if someone was going to be sent to a rehab facility or some place after an operation, the NH Predict algorithm would predict how long, given their health history and some other data, how long they would need to stay there. And what happened was this algorithm was spitting out numbers that were estimating, quote unquote, a level of care that was far lower than what people thought it needed, what patients needed. And so the lawsuit alleges that it was denying care widely. And in fact, apparently employees within United Health were tasked with making sure that claims were denied or that the care was hewing to the paltry level of care that was spit out by the algorithm. It's just a really, really enraging article. If you want to read through it again, find it at the playlist on tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. The conclusion here is that this stuff is real, it's growing, it's widespread, it's affecting people, and predictive AI should be thrown into the river. That's about all the time I have for you this evening, friends. I do have a little bit of homework for you. Before next week, I have some specific suggestions. What I would like you to do is the following. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And for our outro this evening, I thought it'd be good, since we had a computer science professor on the show, if we had a computer-themed song, and it's a song called EEPROM, E-P-R-O-M. You can look it up. It has something to do with computers. The artist is named Waveshaper. And I want you to stay tuned for Dave Mandel coming up next here on WFMU. Thanks, everybody, for your attention, and have a great week. You're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org.
And good evening, folks, and welcome to another bone-chilling episode, installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday at 7 p.m. Jersey City time to play an hour of the best music for you. Thanks for joining me. We're going to start tonight's show with a strange piece that I discovered not too long ago. It's by a guy named Richard Hill. Richard Hill is a British, a composer, producer, conductor. And this is, we're going to hear a track from an album called Chanctonbury Ring. Chanctonbury Ring is a real place in England. And I confess, I hadn't heard of it. I looked it up in Wikipedia and promptly forgot all the details. But basically an old site of some religious significance, I think. And this album was released in 1978, and it's a really odd and rare record. And when I say rare, I don't even have, I only managed to get my hands on two tracks from the album. So that's how rare it is. But they're two good tracks, and I'm going to play one of them, a piece called Sisters of the Moon. This is really an amazing period piece, I guess. Again, Richard Hill was a composer, conductor, and as you might expect, it's a lot of orchestral. It's largely an orchestral piece, but also having been recorded in 1978, there's some kind of borderline disco. It's really an odd amalgam of stuff, but prog adjacent, certainly. So we're going to hear it now. Again, this is a track called Sisters of the Moon from the album Chanctonbury Ring by Richard Hill.